about that. We're going to talk about law and curses.
Foiled again.
And we're going to look at Galatians chapter 3, verses 10 to 12. Kind of picking up from last time, the sense yesterday, getting a notion of promise, what Paul means by promise, and how promise is so important in the sense of going all the way back to Abraham. That is what he received. Promise, where God is the agent, the promise maker, and the promise keeper, is what gives rise to faith, what gives rise to justification, and also that sense of making the present, making the future present for us, that fancy word prolepsis, so that indeed we can already live the future presently. Right. We can already live the promise now. And that is Paul's whole understanding about the Spirit. The Spirit is precisely that being able to live the promise now, which you're not going to get through observing the law. That comes from faith. So what happens then, to pick up on the opposite side of that, that instead of promise and blessing, which was accentuated yesterday, we're now going to look at the sense of law and curse. And for Paul to make his argument in each of the three verses that we're looking at, he quotes a passage from the Hebrew Scriptures, from Deuteronomy, Habakkuk, and Leviticus. And of course, right away you can tell this is a very different way of going about making an argument through scriptures than the way we do, because the way we would do that is we would probably go to one particular text and maybe the whole context and cite it and so on and so forth. Right? Paul is citing three different verses, and no, just single verses, or at times even just a portion of them, that is basically taking out of context, and none of these verses fit together at all. So that's the tip-off, those in the know, that this is going to be some rabbinic exegesis, because the way the rabbis work, they don't care about context or whatever. That what happens is that since God gives all of the scriptures, and those scriptures are there to be used in such a way in terms of association, that a word here can be associated here, can be associated here, and therefore that is what God is wanting to tell you. And so we don't have to, they don't worry about interpreting things in the same way we do. And I hope by the end of our session here, I'm going to show you what Paul is about in terms of rabbinic exegesis, something that we would never do, that we would never think of in terms of how to interpret a text and make an argument. And I just think it's ingenious, so I mean, I don't care what you think about this. I think it's neat. And we'll take a look at that. And this is precisely the place where it would seem to me Paul knows for certain his opponents are going to be hearing this letter or reading it, because these guys, his opponents, who too would be versed in rabbinic interpretation, would know what he's up to. The poor Galatians, they don't have a clue about this. They're just kind of looking at, if you will, the other level. But these particular verses, I think, are addressed to Paul's opponents, and it's, if you will, the section here where he is out-Bibling them, to say, you think you guys know how to interpret Scripture. I'll show you how to interpret Scripture. Okay, Verses 10 through 12. Here's the way I would translate them. For those who are from works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, accursed is everyone who does not remain, or you could say abide, dwell, in all things written in the book of the law, so as to do them. And because no one is justified before God in the law, it is evident that the just one from faith shall live. But the law is not from faith, but the one having done them shall live in them. Okay.
What translation are you reading?
Mine.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
As I translate the Greek.
One of those guys.
Yeah, I'm one of those guys. Right. So, what's happening here, right? Paul is wanting to tell us that curse is the opposite of blessing. The two are mutually exclusive. To be deprived of the blessing means to be deprived of the Spirit. And thus we are stuck in the present evil age, which Paul talked about in chapter 1, verse 4. To be in the evil age means that we are held under control, that we are dominated and enslaved by forces which are against the gracious love of God. And this is again where Paul gets very, very radical, his claim is that the force which enslaves us is the law itself. And we can look at a few verses here elsewhere to see where Paul makes that point. So that, for example, chapter 3, verse 23. And
of Galatians.
Chapter 3, verse 23 of Galatians. Anyone, you've got that, just read that.
Now before faith came, we were imprisoned and guarded under the law until faith would be revealed.
Okay, so about the law there, right?
Imprisoned.
Right. That's not a very nice thing to say about the law. And especially think about that if you're a Jew, right? It's the law that imprisons you, right? I mean, that's not a very good sense that's there. Chapter 4, verses 4 and 5 of Galatians. And again, anybody just give us that.
But when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as children.
Okay. This phrase, under the law. Why is that to be understood negatively? What's bad about being under the law?
Not above the law.
Okay, you're not above it, but how is that notion of under negative?
Somebody's got their thumb on you.
Law's got power.
It's oppression.
You're under somebody's thumb. There's that notion of oppression. There's that notion of domination. Right? It's used again in a fuller context, and even here, right? You are under the powers, or again, to put it within their context, you are under the lordship of someone else. So that one way of upping the ante is to say, okay, who is your Lord? Lord Law or Lord Jesus? That would be mutually exclusive. You could not have the same. One more. Chapter 4, verse 21.
Tell me, you who desire to be subject to the law, Will you not listen to the law?
All right. And what's going on there if you're subject to the law?
It's written for you.
In feudal times, you're the subject of the king or the ruler.
Right. It's that notion, subject is like subjection, or certainly in Paul's time as well, right? Everyone should be a loyal subject of the emperor.
Yeah,
right?
Was the...
And sure, feudal times as well, you would be subject to the king or the duke or whoever is around. So again, it's that notion that in all of these, right?
A subject's almost a slave, right?
Pretty close. And again, there are other places where that's precisely how Paul will talk about it. We are enslaved, we're a slave to the law, or again, if we want to use a feudal kind of word, we're like the serfs. Not to be confused with the Smurfs. Right. Serfs,
very happy.
Serfs to the law and all of that. So with that kind of issue, right, now going back to verse 10 of chapter 3, for those who are from works of the law are under a curse. And then he quotes from Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 26. So let's just read Deuteronomy 27, 26. And again, anyone can read that for us.
Cursed be anyone who does not uphold the words of this law by observing them. All the people shall say, Amen.
Okay. Now is Paul, in verse 10, saying the same thing as what has just been said in Deuteronomy 27, 26?
He's spitting it back at him.
The first one says you should do this and you will do this. And the second one, Paul is saying nobody can do it. Or, you know, it's not possibly human. Everybody's going to not live up to it.
Okay, right. So Deuteronomy is basically saying, if you don't observe the law, you're accursed. And what is Paul saying? Those who are in the law are cursed. The exact opposite. So
well,
what's going
before
on?
Before that, he's got all those curses. And then he says, and all the people shall say, Amen. So you can't mislead a blind man.
Yeah, but if you keep reading, if you will only obey the Lord your God by diligently observing all his commandments that I'm commanding you today, the Lord shall set you high above all the nations, all the earth, all these blessings shall come upon you. So
but see, Paul doesn't care about the context. Don't read all that stuff. Stop that. Right. So what's going on here? If we look at just this verse, right? If you don't observe the law, you're cursed. Paul, those who are in the law are cursed.
Well, isn't he saying that you can't perfectly keep the law, so you're cursed? You're just pretty much
No. He didn't say. He doesn't say anything about perfect.
If your hope is in.
He just says, if you're in the law, you're cursed.
You're imprisoned, you're under subject.
Yeah. So, this is, in my little blurb, from Paul's perspective, whether you're non-observers of the law, whether you're demi-semi-hemi observers of the law, or whether you are full observers of the law, don't make no difference. You're cursed.
But is he
What, I don't see that. In verse 10 of Galatians, maybe I'm just dense. Cursed is everyone who does not observe and obey all the things written in the verse, in the book of the law.
Yep.
Let's remove the word not. So then,
No. Keep the quotation. Go to the clause in front of it for where Paul is telling you what it means in terms of the verse that he's going to cite. Basically, if you will, Paul gives you his interpretation and then says, here's my scripture backup. Right. So he is saying, for those who are from works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, and then exactly what you read, Penny. But you see, his claim, his interpretation is, if you're under the law, you're under a curse.
But then I guess I...
Yeah. Okay.
He doesn't say this, but is his reasoning then, because you can't keep, it's impossible for you to keep the law?
No, that's the way we like to think about it, but he isn't saying that.
I know
at
he isn't
all.
Saying that, but is that what he's...
I don't think so.
Okay.
Hey,
I'm with you, Chris.
that has been a very common interpretation of this, because it's trying to make sense of what Paul's saying. So what it does is hypothesize, or if you will, add another premise that says, well, okay, Paul's conclusion can be true if you add the premise. And of course, we know in theory, since no one can keep the law perfectly, therefore they will all be under the threat of the law. But Paul isn't saying anything in theory. He's saying
works of the law.
Works of the law. Curse.
How did you translate that first sentence on verse 10?
What Paul says there?
Yes.
For those who are from works of the law are under a curse.
From works of the law.
From works of the law. Right.
Couldn't he speak English for crying out loud?
Come out of the law. Karis.
Well, my Bible says, for all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse.
I know, and there is again the translators, especially in the NRSV,
right,
trying to make sense, subjectivize it. If you rely on the law again, you're there. But Paul's sense of those who rely upon, depend upon, that rely upon or depend upon is not in the text. They're adding that. Paul is saying all those who come out of works of the law, who are from works of the law, whose orientation is works of the law, are cursed.
I think, I'm not sure it's even just the modern day, but I know. I think we like to say, well, those ideas, like the list in Deuteronomy, those are all good things for us to do. So how, you know, can we deny those? We don't want it in mind. We want to say, yeah, and we should still, and this is good advice. This is how we should do things. But he's being emphatic, saying that as soon as we do that, then we start putting our trust in them. And that's the danger.
Yeah, but here's what I think is going on. And that is that Paul's argument, again, is if you are from the law, it's a curse. When he cites Deuteronomy 27:26, I think what he's doing here is saying, this is my opponent's position. In other words, what he's saying here is, yep, if you rely on the law, you're under a curse. And now he's going to say, but you know, here's what my opponents say. If you don't observe the law, you're cursed. And now what he's going to do is he's going to say, but you see, their interpretation is incorrect. Because now if you follow through on this, you will indeed see that their position and their interpretation of this verse is wrong.
Because they're saying you must follow.
And I'm going to show you why. Because if they're saying you must follow, I think what he's saying is, and just simply, following law will always leave you under the curse. Right? Very radical. The law is the bad guy. Now, why is he saying that? Let's move on to verse 11. Right? And because no one is justified before God in the law, it is evident that the just one from faith shall live. Okay. And I have here two different ways of interpreting this verse. And because no one is justified before God in the law, it is evident that the just one from faith shall live. That's the first way. Second way. And because no one is justified before God in the law, it is evident that the just one from faith shall live. Significantly different interpretations. What's the difference? Yes, a comma.
Is that the translator's comma?
Yes. Because what one needs to remember is that back then, manuscripts, you needed to save paper or room, all of that kind of stuff. There was no space between words, and two, there was no punctuation. So, right, as you translate this, right, you need to figure out where to do this. Now, the difference here is, and I put the "it is evident," literally this is where this phrase appears in the Greek, and NRSV, in order to have good English, so we can keep Penny happy, right, you know that they put it right at the beginning, "now it is evident." But they still put the comma, or in this case, the semicolon, after law. What's the difference between reading these two this way? Because no one is justified before. Or we can put it here. It is evident. Because no one is justified before God in the law, that the just one from faith shall live. Or, and because no one is justified before God in the law, it is evident that the just one from faith shall live.
It's a difference in premise, right? I mean, the first one, the premise is the first sentence, or the first half of the sentence, and the conclusion is the second half. And in the second, it's the opposite. The premise is the second half. The conclusion is the first.
So the logic is exactly opposite.
The logic is opposite. And you see, that's precisely, again, the issue between Paul and his opponents. They have opposite logic about the working of the law and the working of faith. Right? And the way you catch that is, now in terms of interpretation, where do you put that silly little comma? And I think the way Paul wants us to think about this is the second way. All right. So, sorry, NRSV folks, I disagree with you. And so do other folks. I'm not alone on that one. This is what, because, and again, for what it's worth in terms of kind of old-style Lutheran theology, right, this second one is your because, therefore kind of talk. Because no one is justified in the law, therefore the just one from faith shall live. Right.
Lutheran.
But there's other ways. Where others would say this kind of thing too. So that's what takes us into the interpretation of that sentence. And then we get into this quotation from Habakkuk 2:4. So if someone for us would read Habakkuk 2:4.
Out of the NRSV.
Take a pick because it's going to be a problem.
Look at the proud. Their spirit is not right in them, but the righteous live by their faith.
Okay, so again, you can see Paul's taken it out of context. He's not even interested in the first half of that verse. He's just going to go with what?
The righteous live by their faith.
All right. Here are your options. If you go with the Masoretic text, which is the Hebrew that you find in our kind of text critical editions of the Bible, right? The Biblia Stuttgartensia, right? Which, Becky, you're clutching that to you closely. That would be translated, "The just one in his faith shall live." Now, the interesting thing here is the Septuagint translation, and this is the abbreviation for the Septuagint. Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. And the Septuagint has two different textual readings for this. The reading with the strongest textual support is, "The just one from my faith shall live." The weaker reading, but still there, is, "My just one from his faith shall live." And interestingly enough, this is the one that's quoted in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 38. And here's what Paul says, simply, "The just one from faith shall live." That's what he says here in Galatians. He says the same thing in Romans 1, verse 17. So, right? One thing that should be evident in terms of Paul's quotation over against any of these other quotations is what?
Faith isn't like an owned, it's not his faith or my faith, it's faith.
Right.
So probably the faith of Jesus.
So, right, these pronouns, his faith, my faith. And again, here the "my" refers to God, right? The just one from God's faith shall live, or my just one, God's just one from his faith shall live. And faith here is really understood somewhat as, I guess you could say, faithfulness, right? Faithfulness to God, so on and so forth. That's certainly what Hebrews is saying. That's not necessarily what Paul is saying.
Well, didn't you say that faith is synonymous with belief?
Yes.
Well, that's what that,
believing.
Where the Ephesian verses come in so powerful. You know, that faith is given to us. Faith, you know, we're back to your guest thing almost. The host gives us our faith. And the world has turned that around. It's to the faith that I've nurtured and developed and strengthened, and that's mm-hmm. part of the whole human rebellion. Is they want it. I want to work on my own faith.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud of it. That's a gift.
Okay, but now as well, let's go with Paul's thing, and you can see the different ways of translating it. Three questions I want to ask. First of all, who's the just one?
One who has faith.
The person who is justified.
Well,
Who's right with God?
That's also the word, to me, the reconciled is a word that is warmer for my heart.
Okay.
I'm reconciled with God. I'm his guest, I'm his friend. But it's not.
Well, the opponents would argue those who keep the law, but he just counters that at the beginning of the sentence. He says...
Okay, so you're giving it a negative twist. Perhaps, well, I'm not quite sure who the just one is, but I know who they're not. That is, namely, those who observe the law and think they're just. Okay.
How about the first part of that set of that Habakkuk thing was about the opposite of proud?
Yeah, but see.
He threw that
now,
out.
Now you're a good Western kind of interpreter, which. Would have nothing to do with rabbinic exegesis, because Paul doesn't care what the first half of that verse says. Forget that. See, he didn't quote that. He doesn't care about that. All he cares about is the just one from faith shall live.
Would that be Jesus?
Might be. Well, we'll just throw out candidates. Question number two.
It's not the Pope.
Yeah, that's true. It's not the Pope. Paul wasn't worried about the Pope in his time. The question number two is, does from faith, that prepositional phrase, modify just one or modify shall live? So is the sense of this, the just one from faith shall live, or the just one from faith shall live.
I like the just one shall live from faith. Not a choice you provide to us.
Oh yeah, water or juice? How about some milk?
Well, it depends on who the just one is, right? That's how you
think. Yeah, and that's right. Depending on what you think or who you think the just one is, might influence you on where you want to put from faith. Or perhaps the other way around, where you put from faith will help you understand who is the just one.
So would the just one possibly be Abraham?
He certainly was a candidate for the just one. But, right, Habakkuk isn't talking about Abraham. He's just talking about the just one.
Is he talking about every person in the sense that the one who is justified with Christ? So if you want to cling to anything, you cling to faith.
Okay, well, we can, right, as we, some of us know, that we could almost say, instead of from faith in other places, given the argument Paul makes, we can say, the just one from Christ shall live.
Isn't that really saying the same thing? The just one from faith, the just one from faith shall live. You end up living, and the just part of it has to do with faith either way.
Well, no, because the just one, do you live because of faith, or are you just because of faith?
Content is the same. You're going to end up in the
it's not
like
the same.
The just one, like maybe justified by something else, then from faith shall live, or the one justified by faith.
Let's do one more question to make you
really confused,
even more frustrated with me.
Well, now that we know your goal.
Is the shall live here really talking about life in the present or life in the future?
I even like the word existing.
Abundant life.
shall exist with Christ, but you got the preposition phrase in there. But yeah, I think it's both.
Both.
Forever. It's past the future.
Maybe we're not alive until we're just from faith.
All right, so that means we're not alive until the future, so that right now you're dead?
Just can't appreciate it as much because we have that sin part.
No, that's what I said. Once you are justified through your faith, then you have life, and until then you are dead.
Okay. How does, I'll give you a little...
I'm throwing out frustrating things back.
No, that's all right. I'll give you a little hint here. How does promise help us?
Brings the future to the present.
So that would then give us a sense that of our options between present and future, which one do we want to lean toward?
Present.
And if we're leaning toward the present here, how does that help us understand faith in the just one?
Well, it's something that's existing now. It's available now. I think it's not like in the earthly sense. Just because I'm okay in the future, Kit talked about that last night, just because they thought they were okay in the future. And the present didn't mean they were going to be guaranteed in the future, but with Christ, that's where I'd say both, because if I'm living in that relationship, and then the promise is to continue. And that, whether I live or whether I die, with Jesus.
Yeah. But what it's talking about here, and think about this now in terms of contrasting to observing for the law, Paul's claim here is that, if you will, in the present, those who are just live from faith. Right. So then again, the contrast is here.
What does it mean to live from faith?
Okay.
Does that mean that you make your decisions based upon your faith? Does that mean you...
Can the from be translated by faith?
No, not here.
Okay. That's what my text is. All right, I'm going to throw it
another
out.
Bad Bible. Oh, get rid of it. Well, we have to clean out that rack out there.
NRSV.
Right.
That's about as good as we get here.
Right. The preposition is from or out of. So you're either in law, or for Paul, you're from, or you live out of faith. Right? Now again, if you are in the law, living in the law is going to give you a certain kind of identity, right? Who I am, and then noting who I am means you will conduct yourself accordingly, right? That's how I'm going to live.
And it strikes me that.
And now from faith, of course, also is going to give you an identity. Here, Paul says, as just one, and that too will lead to conduct, namely, how I live.
Now, I was going to say, that first one that strikes me, it's much more defensive, because I'm going to constantly be in fear of falling out of the law and constantly concerned about making sure other people are living within the law. And I can't be a good guest because I'm constantly worried I'm going to break something or break the rule. But on the second one, hey, this is good forever. I can take my shoes off or leave them on. I frustrate people. I usually take my shoes off in Minnesota and a lot of people. But I say, you're not out on the farm anymore. And you don't have a white carpet. Why should I take my shoes off because I cleaned your house? I haven't been in it.
But you see, Paul's thing here, again, is that obviously if in law or from faith are mutually exclusive, then same too, the identities will be mutually exclusive. This is the just one. What's your identity over here?
Cursed.
Yeah. Now you're getting it. This is the cursed one. And of course, conduct, right? This is again observance of law. This is living by promise.
Being a good gift.
Grace, gift, all of that kind of stuff. That's what's going on there. So, we got to get to this one. Leviticus 18:5. Someone read that for us, please.
You shall keep my statutes and my ordinances. By doing so, one shall live. I am the Lord.
Okay, so all Paul quotes again in that is the, you know, the one having done them shall live in them, right? So if you're going to observe the law, you're going to live that way. Here we go.
And thereby end up cursed.
Here's rabbinic exegesis. They associate things. So, here's Deuteronomy. A curse is everyone who does not remain in all the things written in the book of the law so as to do them. Habakkuk 2:4, the just one from faith shall live. Now what Leviticus 18:5 is, what Paul cites, the one having done them shall live in them, basically is composed of words from these first two. He just brings them together. So, the one having done them shall live in them.
I think that's illegal under the Scrabble rules.
And now here's the big thing, and I've given you the answer here. What's missing in this? Right? He pulls down all these words
from
faith. You see, you schmuck opponents who think you understand the Bible, you don't understand it at all. Because if this is the conclusion you've come to, what have you left out? The most important thing God was telling us, just from faith. Boom!
What verse is that schmuck opponents part of?
Isn't this? This is just great stuff. I know you don't have to get it. I get excited about this. This is just superlative. I can use a superlative.
Whoa.
Superlative rabbinic exegesis, right? This is Paul the Rabbi summa cum laude.
Boy, if there were more than two stations in Saskatoon, we wouldn't know this. You wouldn't have had time to figure that all out.
it took a while. but I mean, and again, obviously, you know, those Gentile Galatians, that, you know, they don't know what's, I mean.
I think I heard my mom.
But those opponents who too know Torah and are skilled in it, they put this to, because after all, right, once Paul is citing three different texts like that. I mean, here, you know, the pre-understanding of, okay, this is rabbinic interpretation of scriptures, kicks right in. They're going to do this, and they just know, you know, from this, Paul's argument has just outclassed them.
What do we make of the fact that in the Habakkuk, he kind of freely gave his own wording of it?
Yeah.
That's different from the Septuagint and the Hebrew.
Yeah. Leaving out those pronouns. There's basically two understandings of that. There is a third Septuagintal version or Hebrew version that Paul has that he's citing, or he's citing from memory. And the his and the my are not important.
It's pretty impressive to see Paul's confidence in his argument as far as his own scholarship in this kind of analysis of what he's doing.
Well, I mean, you know, remember, he He does go to grad school in Jerusalem, and you know,
it's the blind man on the road that the Holy Spirit picked up.
Right. He knows what he's doing here, and he's making this argument, rabbinic exegete, or our way of saying this, in terms of saying there is no way one is justified, is validated in God's sight, except, right, coming out of or from faith, right? Even here his claim is, even scripturally, your position cannot be supported. And again, you know, what does that mean for us? It's the kind of thing that would say, well, you know, how do we read and interpret scriptures? Is it just one great big rule book? And say, that's the way you observe it? Or is it, again, for us, a scriptures that provides that foundation that says, from out of faith, reading the scriptures will provide us with our identity and our conduct. But not in terms of rules, because we recognize to be just is not going to depend on rules. If you depend on rules, you end up cursed. You end up under the law, imprisoned, subject. And that's not where you want to be. Because initially, you didn't claim that that was your identity, right? You didn't say, oh, well, if I observe the law, I'm going to be a prisoner. I'm going to be its serf. I'm going to be under its thumb.
Did I do enough good work?
But that's where you are.
Yeah.
So just listening, kind of as we're going through this, it hits me that for Paul, I mean, the gospel really did change his life completely upside down, because he was firmly in the left-hand camp for most of his life, and he doesn't even really seem to show much sympathy for him anymore. It's just really, like you said, what was the term you used?
Schmucks.
Right?
I mean, one way of talking about it is transfer, right? Our whole lives, we are transferred from being this way in the world to now being this way in the world. And it is a, right, a transfer. To use the biblical word here, this is what resurrection is all about.
Yeah.
Right? Because now, right, I have died to this, and now Christ who lives in me means I have been raised and I have this new identity.
And if it was a play, the director might not get enough self-disdain out of Paul as he thinks of his former life, the years he wasted, perhaps, even defending the law. He can't. So his, when you talk about his fierceness or his directness, it's part of that, maybe even, I don't want to say self-loathing, but whatever would be close to that. He just is so frustrated that he wasted so much energy on it.
Well, in Philippians, right, he talks about his former life and everything. He uses the Greek word skibula, which basically means shit. All right, so he goes, yes, I look back at my former life. And we sometimes say, yeah, I look back at my former life. It's just a crock of shit, you know? That's what Paul said.
Now, that would get some attention.
And, you know, in our translations, we always like to be nice. Paul usually is never nice when he's talking to them. I mean, that's how he views, finally, he says, you know, all of this stuff in here. Or as we said earlier today in our woods play, this is Bullgeschichte, right?
Yeah. That was mentioned today in front of some of the younger campers, but I didn't correct them.
Go ahead, Marcus.
Is what's going on here, like, to take it back to the larger picture, I mean, it seems like he's given the Galatians the sort of rhetorical
argument
that you foolish Galatians, and then he's given the interpretive argument through Abraham, and now he's given this other argument that's more pointed. I mean, does this work on the opponents because they know exactly what he's doing here, and they've put their trust in this? This is just another device for trapping them, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same point being reiterated.
It's the same point coming across, yeah, three different ways with the target audience in this one shifted, right? Because as I say, my sense is these three verses are specifically addressed to his opponents. Whereas previously that talk about Abraham and all of that would be for the Galatians and saying, you know, my good friend Galatians, here's what the promise to Abraham is really all about, right? And let's go back to Genesis 15, not Genesis 17, and you know, promise and heirs and all of that. Yeah, so it's the same argument, different target audience. So it's making the point a bit differently. But, as you said, the big picture stays the same.
Well, and that's helpful for today, too, because so often if we take a position, it's not just one disagreement or opposition or issue that we're talking about. People come at us from all kinds of directions when they don't want to follow the plan we suggest or whatever. Multi-levels of response. As Paul, one thing that strikes me is I'm not coming to mind, I'm not a scholar in the detail of it, but does he ever speak of the law as a useful tool in making decisions? Is that ever part of his message that strikes?
No.
So he doesn't go there. It doesn't mean we can't go there, but it's just not part of his position.
I mean, in Romans, which most folks say was written after Galatians, and I think that makes sense, he tempers himself a bit. Right? He is not, right? It's only in Galatians that he links the words law and curse. Right. Whereas he backs off in Romans and basically says, well, you know, we have died to the law. In other words, you know, the law is not particularly useful or helpful for us, except indeed it shows us our sin.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you don't need Moses' law to do that. Pick a law, any law, and it's gonna do that. But you know, it don't. Don't think that the law will ever be able to do what we see on this side.
And in a way, that's the subtle or not so subtle danger, is that we start trying to tack on more things as humans.
Right. Again, I guess kind of my folksy way of saying is our temptation is always to think we can make the law work for us. Right. And that you say, you know, who Jesus is and what Jesus is all about is gives us the grace so that now we can make the law work for us, right? So that we can now observe the law. And Paul's thing is, you know, no. The law will never work for you. In fact, right? And then we go really radical here. The law is the curse. And curses never work for you. Right? They always work against
you. Well, that says a lot about pastoral leadership. I hope they're teaching that right in seminaries. These guys that swing into a congregation are going to save the world for Jesus. It's pretty scary. Or teachers.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's right, or anybody, right?
Yeah.
I mean, again, anyone who has a Messiah complex, who says, I'm, you know, I'm going to save, I'm going to save this congregation, I'm going to save my family, I'm going to save my whatever. Well, you know, you're over here, you know, basically what you end up is you're not the Messiah, you're the curse.
Yeah.
Right? That's a very practical side of this. That's right, George.
Right. I worked with one. No. He didn't believe me. No. Anyway, but no, it is. It's a real issue for the church because especially in well, our culture where, you know, gird up your socks and go work and do Jesus and make them proud, that kind of stuff is really part of the Puritan aspect of our heritage. And it's strong. It's very strong.
Yeah. It's always...
There's a lot of crummy Lutherans who are too puritanical. There's other reasons it's crummy Lutherans.
We're past time again. I've not observed the law well. But
yeah, you really cursed the clock, didn't you?
I've cursed it. Or maybe the clock's cursed me, I don't know. But I mean, please feel free to go if you want to go. If you want to stay around, that's fine too.
Well, I just hope I don't blow out your too radical.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, thank you.